Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, it's episode 601, which means we completely forgot about talking about episode 600 yesterday of the Tennis Podcast. Only 7.5 years of Tennis Podcast that we were intending to celebrate and completely forgot all about. But anyway, that's a sort of tradition here on the Tennis Podcast. We did exactly the same after number 500. And the good news is we have got loads of tennis to talk about today. We don't need to get into Boston Legal, although I suspect it might come up. But Catherine Whittaker is here, live, joining us from the Amazon Prime Video Studios, the dressing room, whilst tennis is going on halfway through the day. What's the latest, Catherine?
The latest is that there's a bloody big inconvenient gap in play.
You say inconvenient. I mean, to me, this is convenient. This is perfect podcast
giant
recording time.
Podcast-shaped gap in play. Yeah, because Djokovic beat Tsitsipas in 58 minutes. I say gap. They've moved the doubles match that was going to be played on court one, the warehouse court, as you put it. They've moved it to centre court, and all four of the players involved look delighted about that. So some bonus
splendid
doubles on centre. Yeah, courtesy of a very confused-looking Tsitsipas and a no-nonsense Novak Djokovic.
Yeah, we'll get straight on to the WTA finals in a second, but actually, just given you're talking about Djokovic there, Catherine, I mean, he was sensational today, wasn't he? I mean, this is a guy who is pretty under the weather this week. He's barely got you wouldn't recognise his voice if you heard it. It sounds incredibly gravelly. He's obviously had a bit of a cold, and he was pretty ropey in his first round match. He got it going against Carl Edmund, but then yesterday, or rather earlier today against Tsitsipas, he was flawless pretty much, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, it was Australian Open final-esque. Yeah, he sounded like Tom Waits all week, Novak Djokovic. He really has sounded ropey. And he was decent, I thought, yesterday against Carl Edmund, particularly in the second set, by far his best set of the week. But today was just, you know, we were bigging that match up so much. Tsitsipas, 2-1 head-to-head, won both their previous hardcourt meetings. Some of the comments from Tsitsipas after he beat Djokovic in Shanghai about how he doesn't fear Djokovic, he thinks Djokovic fears him. You know, it was all, we gave it the massive hype and we thought it was completely justified. And 58 minutes later, we were sat there dissecting an absolute demolition. And poor Stefanos Tsitsipas, we know how confused he gets in these moments. I don't think he's done his press conference yet, but I'm anticipating something along the lines of what he experienced after he got a hiding from Nadal in Australia, which was just a sort of bereft-looking child.
How did that happen, sort of look?
Yeah, but yeah. I'm really good at tennis. How did that happen?
We did actually, I think, pretty much come to the conclusion last night that he would beat Djokovic. So here's us holding our collective hands up. I don't know, but what did you think, Matt? Did you think he would end up winning Djokovic, and particularly in that fashion? I didn't see any of this match because I was busy commentating, but goodness me. The time on it, and also seeing Catherine's post-match analysis with the Amazon Prime Video Studio pundits, I mean, it wasn't even a contest, really.
It was one of those matches where it looked like Tsitsipas's shots were in slow motion, and because Djokovic was just getting there so early with all the time he needed to just rip winners. And yeah, Tsitsipas just looked a little dazed and confused by what was happening to him. So I'm also eagerly awaiting those press conference quotes. But I don't know, it's been one of those days where I've watched two matches back to back now where the first set has just been blistering tennis. It was Djokovic in Paris, and it was Pliskova in Shenzhen. It's just sort of not what I was expecting at all from either match right from the start, and it kind of leaves you a bit confused and immediately puts you on the back foot.
Yeah, well, let's get straight on to that. I should say that Djokovic now plays Grigor Dimitrov. We'll give a little rundown of that in a little while's time. But that Pliskova-Halep match is the crux of the tennis podcast today for a number of reasons. I mean, for a start, it finally felt like we could breathe again with normal tennis going on rather than thinking about round-robin tennis and substandard form and lethargic, lacklustre tennis, which we'd been having most of the week, three players withdrawing out of illness or injury. Suddenly you'd got everything on the line with this match, and Pliskova and Halep came out playing absolutely fantastic tennis. Particularly Pliskova, the first set lasted 20 minutes. She hit 11 winners and 3 unforced errors. It was as though she just decided, I don't care how slow everybody keeps saying this court is, I'm going to pretend it's not slow, and I'm going to absolutely belt everything. Everything was coming out of the middle of the racket. She was sensational. Second set, I felt Halep was equally sensational because she put it behind her. She had a brief on-court coaching visit at the end of the first set with Darren Cahill, who was quite quick to say, look, you just got a full reboot now. You've got to go full reboot, which she did. She started running everything down. She turned the tables. I didn't even think Pliskova was playing badly in the second set. The point Cahill was making at that stage was you're putting everything in the pocket for her. You're putting everything at hip height for Pliskova. She's loving it. Stop playing so flat. Start playing loopy topspin shots and getting the ball up on her, which she did. And she was brilliant. So we're in this perfect position of one set all. It was the match of the week. Gets to 3-2 in the third set. And again, incredibly competitive 5 games. Long fifth game. Then Darren Cahill came onto the court and delivered an on-court coaching visit, the likes of which I don't think I've seen from anybody, let alone from him. I've certainly never been as shocked by an on-court coaching visit as I was from this one, because he said to her, he came onto the court and he said, Simona, look at me. She didn't look at him. And he said, the last 3 games, you've been a disgrace on the court. He went on to say, come on, you've got to reel it in. Get your focus back between the lines. For no reason, you've lost it here. You have a chance to define yourself now in this set. Forget the result. How are you going to finish this match? It's up to you. She then went out and lost 8 of the next 9 points and went from being on serve at 2-3 to being 2-5 down. She then got herself together, played, I think, 8 or 9 really good points and got herself to 4-5 down, but eventually lost it. And it's a very strange feeling to immediately go from talking about a fantastic match and a week and, in fact, a career's worth of hailing Darren Cahill, the on-court coaching master, to suddenly feeling, I can only speak for myself, quite uncomfortable with what he actually said to her and the way he said it. I know you haven't had a chance to see this, Catherine, but Matt, you did.
I have now, actually.
You have. Okay, what were your reactions?
Well, I'd been prepared for it because I hadn't been watching it live. I came off air, found all of your... I couldn't quite believe what I was reading, actually, with your two messages back and forth about it. Read the transcript and then really struggled to find a clip of it online, which tells you a story in itself, doesn't it? If people were reluctant to clip it up and put it out there, I think that tells you perhaps the discomfort in the general reaction to it, because usually something like that, a dynamic on-court coaching exchange, particularly with those two, you'd find it clipped up and online in an instant. I'm interested to know what Halep says about it. I suspect that Halep is probably okay with it, not okay with losing the match, but I think, and therefore if Halep's okay with it, should we all be okay with it? I think the answer is no, because I think the public nature of those exchanges does give the people involved a slightly wider responsibility. And I did feel uncomfortable watching it because of the power dynamic that it laid bare. It looked like a grown up telling off a child, and that isn't how I want a player coach relationship to feel. And it never is how Halep and Cahill feel. I mean, he sometimes gives her a hard time, but it's always conversational. It's always a dialogue. It's always inviting her to give her views of how she feels she's doing and what she's doing right and wrong. And this felt like a belittling and a telling off. And it was uncomfortable to watch, regardless of how Halep herself feels about it. She may well not have been uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I think there's more to it than how she felt about it.
Just to give a little bit of further context, we then had on BT Sport where I was commentating. I mean, my immediate reaction was, "What are you doing? Don't talk to her like that." Was my immediate feeling on it. I didn't say that at the time. I listened to it, but that's how I felt. Joe Jury, who was alongside me, was shocked and said that she thought it was too much. She also went on to say that when she was coached by Alan Jones, he would give her a real telling off at times if he didn't think she was doing the right things, but it would always be in private. Now, of course, this is different. It's on-court coaching, and there wasn't on-court coaching back when Joe was playing. And I know Joe actually doesn't believe in on-court coaching, incidentally. And I also should say that there's a danger of some people like me wanting to have our cake and eat it, because I'm always talking about how I like aggro. I'm always talking about how I like on-court coaching, because we get to see and hear these conversations publicly that are entertaining. I was walking out and probably enjoying the drama of it all on one level, and yet at the same time, here I am saying I didn't enjoy it and felt a bit uncomfortable with it. So I'm well aware of my own hypocrisy, or how it could be viewed as hypocrisy there. Nigel Sears and Annabelle Croft were both in the stadium at the time, and they made the point that the body language of Halep in those three games that preceded this visit were clearly riling Cahill. You could see that this was a build-up, and that she was, I think, ignoring him, gesticulating towards him in a way that was just, yeah, he'd had enough. And there are also times, I think, when we watch Andy Murray behave like that, where I think the first thing I want somebody to do is go and say, you know, call him out on it, or give him a telling off himself, or take him to task on it. And we don't get to see that. Matt, what was your immediate reaction?
Well, my immediate reaction was, I cannot think of another example where a player has been told to their face, and yet also publicly, by a member of their own support team, that they've been a disgrace on a tennis court. It was a pretty extraordinary thing to witness in the moment. Now, Darren Cahill knows Simona Halep better than I do, better than we do. He knows her pretty well. And obviously, he thought that kind of the tough love was the way to go in that moment. And I genuinely do think he had her best interests at heart when he was saying that. But I didn't like it. I think the choice of words was one thing. The tone was another, that you've both talked about, how it was quite aggressive and didn't create the usual feeling that you have with a Darren Cahill coaching session, where you feel like, as you said, it's a conversation, it's a dialogue. He so often starts his coaching timeouts with, okay, what are you thinking? Tell me, talk to me. And I really admire, as much as what he says, the way he says it usually. So I feel a bit conflicted. I feel like I've seen him in a different light in this on-court coaching session, which we saw. And it didn't work, because Cahill himself talks about his advice lasting for short chunks. Like, he talks about very, very directly, very openly about his advice wanting to last two games. Like, this is it. Concentrate on these next two games. Or these next 7 minutes, I think he mentioned earlier on in the tournament. Well, the next two games, Halep was completely out of it, as though, you know, she couldn't win. She could barely win a point. And it was almost as though he'd said all this nuanced stuff as well about getting your energy back, refocusing. But it was as soon as he'd used the word disgrace, it was like Halep couldn't look past that. It was just, that was the word she was then fixated on quite naturally. and it reflected in her tennis. And yeah, I didn't like it at all. And it'll be interesting to see what Halep does say about it. I don't suppose she will speak out against it, but just as a viewer, it was really uncomfortable, I thought.
And actually, yeah, I said at the time in commentary that after those 9 points, of which she'd won just one, she was bailing out on rallies as if, I'm not going to knuckle down, I don't care anymore, a little bit. There was a petulance to the way she was hitting the strokes. Then she did seem to dial herself back in, but I think she probably was in a bit of shock after being spoken to.
But he spoke to her like she was a child.
Mm.
So, and she responded petulantly, like in a slightly childish manner, which I think I might have done as well.
Mm. It's a fascinating case study, really.
Mm.
And yes, it will be interesting to see where they go from here. And I am quite well aware of how it isn't just straightforward, this. I know how I felt about it, but I'm also...
Would we feel differently about it if she'd won the next however many games, 4 or 5 games, and won the match?
That's a very good question.
If it had worked.
I know I didn't like it at the time, and I don't think that element would have changed, but maybe my reflection on its effectiveness might have done. I mean, the fact that she got herself together eventually and made it competitive at the end is one thing, but the fact is they were at 3-2 in the final set. She was 2-3 down in the final set, having just played a very, very good game and only just failed to win it. And then she lost 2 games in the space of about 3 minutes. So she's 2-5 down. So as a shock tactic, clearly that didn't work. The other thing is, he also said it's not even about the result. It's about, I'm sure he's well within his rights to feel this, it's about your application, your attitude, your behaviour on court. It's just that maybe that would have been better off said afterwards.
Do you think her attitude, behaviour on court for those 3 games that he was referencing was disgraceful?
No.
I mean, I wouldn't have used those words. I wouldn't use that word. I do think she was letting it get to her. That even on TV, it was clear that she was starting to throw the racket about, or, you know, she was starting to act petulantly already. And according to Nigel Sears and Annabel Croft in the stadium, it looked worse in person, her behaviour, than it did on TV. I still don't think... I've seen worse from her, put it that way.
I thought she was really frustrated not to go up a double break. She had break points at 2-love, didn't manage to get the double break, then played a poor game to lose serve, and then the 2-all game was fantastic. They were both playing really well. Pliskova was having to play like she did in the first set just to win that game, sort of middling the ball, hitting winners. Halep was coming back at her. And yes, she was getting frustrated, but I really don't think it was anything more than just frustration at the situation, tension with the match, with everything on the line. I really don't think it was a disgrace, to use that word.
Yeah. It's a shame in a way to be taking away from what was a really a fantastic match. And look, again, this kind of adds to it. It was dramatic. It was interesting. There was a big crowd in today who were really engaged. There were fans on both sides. We've got a football team from the Czech Republic chanting Pliskova. We've got all of Simona Halep's normal amount of fans chanting her name. It was great atmosphere, and Pliskova was just playing so well. The quality was exceptional throughout the whole match. But she held it together at the end, and she got the win. But it's just interesting seeing that the on-court coaching dynamic, and one of the most respected coaches in the sport, who I don't think I've ever thought has come on and got it wrong before. I never ever remember thinking that, but I did this time. And it just, yeah, I just, I find it really interesting as a talking point.
It felt just on the crowd, it felt in the stadium a little bit like what I'm anticipating the Madrid Davis Cup finals to feel like, with a largely neutral crowd and pockets of really vocal support. Mm. You had the Romanians and the Czech kind of going up against each other. And it did create quite a nice vibe in that stadium. And just Pliskova, she must be a difficult player to really support, because even when she's playing well, she makes it look quite easy with that demeanor. It's quite casual. And I think that can work against her when she's playing badly. It can almost look like she's not trying, but that's just the way she is. But when she's playing well, she it's fascinating to watch, but even then she doesn't necessarily give you a load. She doesn't, she's not fist pumping all the time.
But today I felt she was, her tennis was uplifting. I thought that's the best tennis I've seen her play all year. That first set, she was awesome.
Semi-final. How did she suddenly manage to do that today?
But my sense, I mean, look, it's difficult to know exactly, of course, but my sense was that, right, we've got that out the way. We've got the round robin out the way effectively. This is a playoff now to get to the final, to the semi-finals. And I think she just went out there and thought, you know, I can only win this by blasting her off the court for a start. So I think she was clear in her own mind of how she had to go about it. And I think the finish line is kind of in sight. I've got to win three more matches and I'm going to go for it. She went out, she went for everything. Even when it wasn't working in the second set, she didn't back off. She didn't start rallying and playing tentatively. She just went for it. And the sound coming off her racket, Catherine, you would have loved. I know, you know sometimes you hear that sound when somebody's middling the ball. I think Matt came up with the line on Twitter. He said she's playing Urban Dictionary tennis because all of those words like zoning and treeing and lights out tennis were what came to mind watching the way she was hitting the ball and the sound off the strings. Oh, you know, you just wanted to wallow in that. It was a joyful experience to watch her play today.
Like the sound of snapping a carrot.
Yes, it was like that. It was like normal descriptions weren't enough, so you had to go to these slightly absurd tennis-only descriptions like treeing and lights out, and it was like the anti-Federer match at the O2 last year. Do you remember when it felt like he didn't have the strings in his racket? This felt like Pliskova only had the middle strings in her racket, and everything was coming out of them. It was a joy. Yeah.
It was. So that's Simona Halep's season over. I tend to agree with you, Catherine. I suspect she will talk and there won't be any problems at all from her side of things because I've seen it in the past. She views things in a different way and fair enough to her for that. But it'll be an interesting one to follow that well over the next year anyway. Now, she will now face... Pliskova will face Ash Barty in the semis tomorrow. Alina Svitolina played Sofia Kenin, the other alternate, today, and eventually got the job done in straight sets, I think once again on her sixth match point. She has played Kenin now five times. Every one of them has been an epic. This was well over 2 hours for two sets, and Kenin played really well. She's got the most incredible drop shot, which was just driving Svitolina to distraction. And if you consider Svitolina was already guaranteed to be qualified, guaranteed to win the group, and yet she still fought her heart out. I think that there must have been I certainly suspected that there might be a tendency for a player in that position to just think, you know what, I don't want to drain myself ahead of what is a massive match tomorrow against Belinda Bencic, but she won it.
It was a really difficult balance that she had to strike, I think. She didn't want to lose momentum by putting in a bit of a shoddy performance, and yet equally she didn't want to get herself embroiled in some kind of three set marathon because she has to play tomorrow against Bencic. But I thought she was really good at lifting her intensity right when she needed to, because Kenin served for both sets and slightly helped Svitolina by getting a bit tight, but Svitolina raised her game in those moments as well. And it's starting the big question of this tournament now. It feels like who's got the tools, the patience, the weaponry to hit through Svitolina on this court, because she is hitting the ball really well and she's moving so well and looking really tough to stop. But I thought Kenin was a real credit, actually, because, you know, coming in for one match as an alternate, I know there's all sorts of prize money on offer, but, you know, she really dug in and was gutsy and gave a really good account of herself. It was David Ferrer-esque when he saved the ATP finals that time by playing that three set match. And it's not been a WTA finals that has been short of bad matches short of good matches necessarily, but it felt like it needed a bit of a boost, and Kenin did help provide that today.
No, today was good in that regard.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Catherine, I mentioned Grigor Dimitrov earlier on. So he is through to the semis. How's he done that?
He played really, really well. First Masters semi since Monte Carlo 2018. And he's had this weird year where I believe he started the year 19 in the world, dropped down to 78 before the US Open, and he's now going to end the year around about 19, possibly a bit better if he beats Novak Djokovic tomorrow, which is highly unlikely given their head-to-head, although I do remember saying similar things a couple of months ago before he played Federer in New York. So I suppose stranger things have happened, although I think it might be even stranger if he were to beat Djokovic tomorrow. But what a weird year. Mm. What a weird year. And just, yeah, I know you balked yesterday when I compared Dimitrov to Ostapenko, but this has come out of nowhere. He lost round one in Beijing. He lost round two in Stockholm, round one in Stockholm, round two in Vienna. I mean, he's done absolutely nothing. And now this, just like coming into the US Open. It's great. It's great to see. Yeah. But
He can turn it on. I don't get it anymore. He doesn't know when he's going to turn it on either. That's the interesting thing. Djokovic, I mean, the other thing is, apart from Djokovic suddenly having found his form and despite the cold he's had, this world number one end of year ranking is a big deal to him, isn't it? I don't know how much he'll say that, but, you know, he's trying for a sixth year-end number one, which would take him ahead of Federer, who's got five. I think Nadal, the one who's trying to usurp him, he's got four at the moment. And Pete Sampras is the record holder on six. Sampras did six in a row. So he could draw level with him on that record. And I know how much that record meant to Sampras. I remember the year he got it in 1998, sixth year in a row. I was around the circuit then. That was my first year as ATP communications manager. And he was quite awesome that year in at the ATP finals, but he was so stressed out in the run-up to it.
Yeah, Greg remembers it vividly.
Yeah, well, he was part of the stress because he went and beat Sampras in Paris in the final, didn't he?
Greg gladly contributed to Pete Sampras's stress. He remembers the goatee that Sampras grew at the time, and he said that Sampras was carrying a back injury, and he said he thinks that was possibly slightly psychosomatic due to the stress he was experiencing, because he wanted it so much. And he said it was alarming seeing Sampras like that because he was usually, you know, horizontal.
Yeah, and you know, I remember that back injury because I remember taking him off the court as the communications manager to his live interview straight after the match. And when he got into the studio of the interview, while he was waiting to go onto the set, he lay down in front of me and started to do all sorts of elaborate back exercises to try to loosen his back up. And then the next day, his prospective second opponent withdrew injured, so Sampras had a bye. That guaranteed him the year-end number one. And the next day, he shaved off his beard.
It was Rios that withdrew,
right,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Greg recalled that as well. He said he remembered seeing Sampras and just you could see the relief on his face. I mean, it's a very different situation for Djokovic because Djokovic basically has to win every match now until the end of the year, and he knows that. And I actually think that him being the chaser is helping him.
You could see him having a target.
He's chasing a target.
And I think he might also need Nadal to lose a match against someone else. I think if he beats Nadal in both the Paris final and the London final, I still think that will be enough for Nadal to clinch number one. So it's a little bit out of his control, but
right.
You could feel like the pressure will be on if Djokovic does win Paris. And Nadal very rarely goes through London undefeated, getting through to the final. But I don't know. Just you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this feels like the one remaining really major record that Sampras has got left. I really feel quite sorry for him.
Everyone, you've got Connors is holding on to his titles record.
Yes,
Federer is closing down, and Connors thought he would never be overtaken. And Sampras,
Federer's just going to play Basel for the next decade. He'll retire from all other tennis and keep playing Basel
and Newport
until he's got Connors' record.
I think Connors is going to come out of retirement and play Atlanta or something. And Sampras.
But of course, Sampras. I mean, I suppose you could say Sampras did it six in a row.
Which is
incredible. But then you could make the argument that it's more incredible to have done it over the longer. Mm. I know he hasn't done it yet, but if he does,
and with this number of opponents, of the likes of Federer and Nadal. I mean, yes, longevity is part of it. He's got more years in which he was able to do it than Sampras, because Sampras maybe didn't play as long. But you're right. I mean, he has the chance, Djokovic, here to be the most dominant player of the era based on world number ones, which...
We've got to find Sampras another record that he can have. There must be some sort of aces record.
Well, nobody's breaking
Goran
six in a row.
Goran has all of those, doesn't he?
Nobody in this era will break six in a row, which is incredible.
No.
And he did think he was safe with that record. I know he did. But anyway, he's still one of the all-time greats, isn't he? Just a quick word on Joe Wilfried Tsonga I wanted to mention. He's in the, as we come to you, we're halfway through the session, aren't we? There's two more semis to come. Tsonga, I think he fought back from match points down against Jean-Ledard Struff last night. Just really impressive and quite heartwarming to see Tsonga having a bit of a go like this in the Renaissance.
Yeah, there's this really nice... quotes he gave about dropping down to the Challenger circuit, which he's done, I think, three times this year, most notably after the US Open in a bid to find a bit of form. And he said, as much as finding form, it actually really helped him find the reasons why he's playing tennis again, because you realize down there that people are scrapping away, they're fighting, and you're playing on smaller courts and you feel a closer connection to the crowd. And it really seems to have lifted him for this sort of last period of the season. And he's got a really good record in France indoors this year. It would kind of pass me by a little bit, but he won both Metz and Montpellier. He's got the most indoor wins on the ATP Tour this season.
And he and Djokovic are the only former champions in this draw.
Mm. All right. So well, that's going to be interesting tonight.
Yeah, and we've been, you know, considering, I mean, there's no shortage of stories like this in tennis, but, you know, we talked a lot about Caroline Wozniacki's rheumatoid arthritis diagnosis. We talk a lot about Venus Williams' Sjogren syndrome, various other things. I'm not sure we've ever talked about Tsonga's sickle cell anemia diagnosis that he told us about earlier this year. I think it was before Indian Wells that we heard about it for the first time. That's a really serious, debilitating condition. I know you can go through periods where you're relatively unaffected by it, but when you have a crisis, a flare-up, it causes excruciating pain. And it's a condition that takes an awful lot of management. And, you know, given where he was in his career, in his personal life, it would have been very easy, very, very easy for him to step away from the game. Mm. He obviously felt like he wasn't done. And it's pleasing to see that tenacity and that dedication to the sport kind of vindicated.
And he's lovely, isn't he? He's a great guy and lovely, great fun to watch. So good to have him back. It's between Monfils and Berrettini now, isn't it, for the final place?
Yeah, pretty simple. If Monfils beats Shapovalov tonight, honk, soon to be out of date tennis news, honk, then Monfils qualifies for London. And if he doesn't, then Berrettini qualifies for London with what would be the lowest ever points total for a London qualifier. If Monfils wins today but loses tomorrow or Sunday, then it would still be the lowest points total. Monfils would need to win the tournament in Paris, which I think is one of those stats that reveals a lot. About an awful lot of things about the year in tennis and where men's tennis is at. It's a really revealing statistic, that.
Yeah, really suggests that those top players have hogged the points, and then there's just sort of been slim pickings for everyone else. I do think it's interesting that if Djokovic or Nadal doesn't win, if neither of them win Paris, then the split on big three winners of Masters titles this year versus non-big three winners would be in favour of the non-big three. And that would be the first time that's happened for a little while. So it does suggest that this slight shift is happening away from the Grand Slams, but obviously they've won the last, what is it? I've lost count. How many? 11?
4,000, Matt. 4,000.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah, that's right.
And then Djokovic goes and slams Tsitsipas 6-2, 6-2. Should also say one bit of news reaching us today, and it's no great surprise to me, is that Raymond Slaughter and Kiki Bertens are no longer working together. That was announced straight after pretty much Bertens' final match there in the WTA finals. I got slight wind of this by the fact that I invited Raymond Slaughter onto the podcast this week, and he said, not right now, David. I'd like to have some more clarity.
Any other time.
He said, we're on a break at the moment, so I need some clarity before I can talk publicly, and he's promised to come on in the future once he's had a bit of a break. But basically she has said, you know, sometimes you have to make tough decisions. They've been together for 4 years. Everything I've achieved would not have been possible without him. As a player and a person, he's helped me grow. And he said, I'd like to thank her for her trust, hard work and dedication over the last 4 years, and wishes Elise Tamaella, who's the new coach who was with Kiki Bertens in Shenzhen, wishes them the best of luck. And whilst, I mean, look, on a personal note, I think an awful lot of Raymond Slaughter as a person, and I actually think he's an excellent coach as well. But it is also on the other side, and I don't know Elise Tamaella, but isn't it great to see a woman given that job and obviously thriving, and it's a good opportunity for her as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Here.
Right then, Catherine, go and present some tennis on telly. Matt, go and edit this podcast and upload it. And we've been the Tennis Podcast for a 601st time.
Can I just say, Catherine?
Yeah.
I was watching the Prime coverage earlier, and you sprung on me out of nowhere, highlights of Andy Murray winning in Antwerp, and I just went. I wasn't ready for it. It was... It was the first time I'd actually seen it on a big screen.
We were filling.
I'd only ever could have watched the highlights really on my phone before, and suddenly it appeared on this big screen, and it was all the more impactful and emotional all over again.
Daniela had tears in her eyes as well.
How lovely.
I was coaxed into the what now for Andy Murray chat.
Oh, yes. What was the result of that?
Well, we all agreed to enjoy it for what it is and not talk about the future, whilst also saying, yeah, you can challenge at the Australian Open.
So you just went back a little bit into tennis podcast land in the last few seconds of the chat, where we absolutely predict the future when we have no idea. Okay, well, we've been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by tennisballs.com with our mascot Rhea with a Y. Leave us a review on iTunes right now. Go and subscribe to our newsletter, which is going out very shortly, actually. So get scrolling down your show notes on your phone and click and sign up to the newsletter and tell everybody you know about the podcast. We'll be back with two more of these over the weekend. Podcasts coming out of your ears. Speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.